Hello, nerds, and welcome to the Engadget podcast. This is episode 36, Bad and Bougie. And already, one of my co-hosts, Sherlyn Lowe, is shaking her head.
I always shake my head at you, though, T, so hi.
Why do you hate the Migos so much?
I don't hate the Migos. I just don't like that you're using it. You're appropriating.
That's it.
Okay.
All right. Also joining me, Dana Woolman.
Yo, what's poppin', slime?
You are the worst. Just the absolute worst.
I'm the best, actually.
You channeling Chris Velasco might be great.
What is worse, her channeling Chris Velasco or me using Amigos for the song for title of this podcast?
You, still.
Okay.
Hands down, always.
I am usually the worst.
That's true.
How are you guys doing in general on this fine Thursday morning?
I'm all right. Hanging in there.
Hanging in there?
Yeah.
Doing lovely.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You did your homework last night, which
I did.
I'm excited about.
Yes.
We're going to talk about Little Shop of Horrors later.
Yes. I did my homework and I live tweeted it.
Oh, nice.
I missed the live tweet, so I'm going to have to go back and look that up. We will make sure. I said I was going to do this last week, link to your live tweet of Jaws in the description of the podcast. I forgot to. I should rectify that, but I will make sure to link to the live tweets of Little Shop of Horrors.
That's okay. Episode. They're pretty inane.
I'm on your live tweet right now, so.
I mean, to be fair, this whole project is a little bit inane.
Yeah.
In general, it's
true.
We're trying to give Dana a little pop culture entertainment and expose her to a lot of movies that she should have been exposed to a long time ago.
Sounds like a Devendra kind of idea.
This is actually Dana's idea.
Oh,
she
nice.
Came up with this on her own, decided this should be an ongoing segment on the podcast. And now we have a list of somewhere in the range of like 120 movies.
We have about a year and a half, year's worth.
Yeah.
Year and a half worths.
To be fair, we can definitely trim that list down quite a bit. It was mostly just like a brainstorming document where every time I thought about a good movie, it got dropped in there.
I like this.
But first,
we need to get to the news of the week. And we're going to do a sort of themed episode this week and kind of focus on two stories of bad behavior at the corporate and executive level. And we're going to start by talking about a frequent name that pops up in these sorts of stories, and that is Uber.
Yeah, let's just breathe air into the mic.
Just everybody groan audibly.
We had a few weeks respite, but now we're back with Uber.
Yeah, I mean,
the Uber thing again.
It seems like every, I don't know, I want to say 2 to 3 weeks at least, Uber and Travis Kalanick, right? That's how you pronounce his name, I assume.
Yeah, sure.
Are doing something to get themselves in trouble and generate a whole bunch of bad press. And the most recent is the revelation of this program called Hell, which was the counterpart to their Godview or Heaven program for tracking their own drivers.
Mm-hmm.
So, Dana, are you all sorts of caught up on this? Do you want to give us a little quick rundown?
Yeah, so Hell is basically this was designed to identify which drivers were also driving for Lyft and then lure them away and make them, if possible, Uber-only drivers. And so Uber didn't involve any hacking or anything explicitly untoward, but basically they exploited a loophole in the Lyft app where it was clear that different drivers had fixed identification numbers that didn't change from one day to another. And so based on that and also just their location against Uber drivers' locations, it was possible for Uber to have a very good idea of who was driving for both. And then once they knew that, they could do things like observe people's driving habits, and then they could also offer them incentives, ultimately, to not drive for Lyft as much. They'd send more fares their way.
Mm-hmm.
There were bonuses involved.
There's a whole bunch of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it doesn't appear that Uber did anything illegal in this case, right? I mean, it seems seems pretty clear that, at least purely legally speaking, this is on, you know, the up and up. But ethically, it seems like it's kind of in a gray area. I don't know what you guys think.
I think that, I mean, some lawyers or speculated that there are possible breach of contracts, unfair business practices, and apparently misappropriation of trade secrets and stuff like that. It's possible, but there are no like real legal implications right now, maybe because the laws are so gray.
Yeah, that's the sort of stuff that's kind of difficult to prove, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it's chances that it's going to result in some sort of charges against Uber or Kalanick are slim to nil.
And there's also a fine line between ethical and shrewd, you know? Like, it's hard to kind of make that judgment.
So that's sort of like one of my big questions here is, you know, it's, at least on the face of it, seems like it's really kind of clearly ethically questionable at best. But you also do have to acknowledge that they're a company and they have a responsibility to make money as a company. If you're not making a profit, then you're not doing your job, basically. So if a competitor leaves themselves exposed in this way, is that your responsibility then to use that to your own advantage?
So I think in a vacuum, that might not bother me as much, right? I mean, Uber is not in a unique position of having a very obvious direct competitor. But I think taking a broader view, Uber seems less focused on making sure it has the best product on the market. It seems a little more focused on sticking out its foot and tripping the other person. And I'm trying to think of other famous rivalries in the business world, not even tech per se, where this has been the case. You don't really see McDonald's trying to sabotage Burger King or vice versa. You see them competing in other ways. I'm just trying to think of a parallel to Uber and Lyft.
I mean, I think certain people might make the argument that we've seen this similarly with Microsoft in the past during their heyday. You know, Microsoft made a big splash of like buying up anybody who could potentially be seen as a competitor, building out a product that pushed people out of other market areas, and were pretty famously, I want to say, in the 90s, the subject of like antitrust law,
yes,
lawsuits and stuff around the inclusion of Internet Explorer as being the default browser, mm-hmm, on Windows. So, I mean, I think you could probably draw some parallel there, at least. Or at least some people would.
I guess my question is, if Uber went about this a whole different way, like they directly asked their drivers, and maybe they already do so, like, are you driving for another company at the same time? Then they could, you know, use a more above board way of doling out these incentives.
Well, I mean, I think that gets into a problematic area, though, probably for them as well, seeing as how these drivers are not employees.
Yeah.
And so what they do on their downtime is really more or less their own business.
An optional thing they want to declare. They can do it. But I get it. I mean,
well, and also, too, Uber would have had an incentive not to publicize this, not just because they look like assholes, but because ultimately they apparently shuttered this program when Lyft expanded to so many cities that it would have Uber would have lost too much money paying bonus payouts in all those cities.
Yep.
So I think to have made public to drivers that they would be incentivized for also driving for Lyft, you just would have had a lot of signups on Lyft, which would have been good for the competition.
Mm. True.
So you kind of hinted at this before, though, Dana. Is this the sort of thing that you probably would be willing to overlook or not that make a big deal about if it was a different company? Like, has Uber just at this point lost the benefit of the doubt completely?
I think so. And, you know, it is hard to say what I would say about this if it were a different company with a totally blank track record. But here... It sort of underscores an opinion I already had, right?
Yeah.
I didn't think too highly of Uber, at least from an ethical standpoint, until now. And I don't know if this doesn't help things, maybe worsens them slightly.
It's not their worst offense, to be clear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think part of the problem, at least for me in my mind, is that it's hard to kind of separate the Hell program from its quote-unquote partner program in the God view,
mm-hmm,
which, for those who don't know, is how Uber tracks all of their drivers. They have this program that's pretty much open to most employees of the company so that they can see where all of their drivers are at any time, which makes sense and has a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But Uber also got in trouble for abusing that system and using it to do things like track journalists who are critical of it, which is why it's probably a good idea that none of us use Uber.
That's the thing, is the line between Uber quietly bullying Lyft and bullying its own employees and even bullying sometimes its customers is a slippery slope.
Yeah.
A blurred line, I should say, if I don't want to mix the metaphors, but yeah.
You mix all the metaphors you want, Dana. Yeah. It's your show.
It's delicious.
So it's... I think one of the things that's kind of gotten lost in some of the coverage of this, too, though, that I think is kind of interesting is it's been a lot of focus on what this Uber is doing to its competitors and how it's doing all of this tracking. But a big part of this was them trying to lure people away from Lyft driving exclusively for Uber, which is, you know, a goal that I understand. But it seems like they did it at the cost of loyal Uber drivers, basically.
Right.
Which
right.
doesn't exactly instill a lot of confidence from people who are working for you.
Yeah.
So what they were doing was monitoring traffic and looking for where rides were coming from and intentionally directing more rides to drivers who were driving for both Uber and Lyft in hopes that those drivers who were kind of, what do they call it,
double dipping or something?
Yeah, they have a word for it.
Double apping?
Double apping, I think, is the word they use, which is, by the way, a terrible, terrible word. And try to convince them to switch over to being full-time Uber drivers by basically making it like, well, all of your rides are coming from Uber anyway, so you should just give up on Lyft and do this full-time. But this meant that they were sending less rides to the people who had stuck by them from moment one.
I mean, if I am embarrassingly enough still an Uber user, and... I mean, I speak to the Uber drivers frequently, and most of them are really upset at anything Uber does, although considering I'm mostly taking Ubers in New York City, that's kind of understandable. But, I mean, I don't think the drivers themselves are all that happy with Uber anyway. It just is the biggest player in the industry, and they almost have no choice but to at least double app, if not, you know, try Uber exclusively.
So I don't like defending Uber, but I'll say this, and I'm not saying this just to be contrarian, but there are parallels to what Uber is doing in the business world in general. I think the people who are talented but appear to be less satisfied or are making more of a stink about, let's say, their salary are more likely to get something, whether it's a raise or some other accommodation. I think there is something to the adage of the squeaky wheel gets the grease, at least if that person is also talented and valuable. And I think you see that in other industries, including ours. So I'm not that surprised to see that Uber is letting things lie with the drivers who seem content
right,
and don't seem like they're about to jump ship.
Right.
But isn't that, in some ways, I guess, kind of counterproductive? If their goal is to get as many drivers into the system as possible and, you know, you'd want to build that sense of loyalty, not saying that you need to be going out of your way to reward the loyal drivers. Again, that's kind of like a decision for how you want to manage your employees, in quotes, because they're not actually employees. But... if you've been driving for Uber for a year and all of a sudden you're seeing the number of fares that you pick up drop because Uber is directing more people to these drivers who are double apping or whatever, wouldn't that make you consider doing that yourself and maybe giving Lyft a shot or some other
service? Yeah.
Where you
to your point, exactly counterproductive. The second this comes to light, first of all, I mean, now everyone's going to just try to double app to get all of the incentives. But obviously the way to make, you know, people want to exclusively drive for Uber is to provide more incentives to exclusively drive for Uber, not the other way around. Give incentives to those who are double apping. So this is kind of a roundabout way that they themselves are very pleased with themselves for. So
I get the feeling that Uber and Travis Kalanick are constantly very pleased with themselves.
Happily just patting themselves on the back.
I mean, we don't really need to discuss whether or not Kalanick needs to resign. I think we've all had our say on that one before.
Mm-hmm. And he's not going to.
Oh, no, he's not. It doesn't really matter.
So, yeah, it's a moot question.
But I think sort of the bigger question is, you know, how long before all of this bad press really starts to hurt the company. You know, it seems like a pretty constant barrage of bad news cycles for Uber. And while I'm sure it's hurt at least somewhat, it hasn't seemed to do any serious damage to the company yet.
I think it's because they haven't IPO'd yet or gone public yet. Because if they did, then anytime this news breaks out, investor sentiment would fall, and then share prices would fall, and then they would, you know, suffer loss.
Like what happened with United this week when it had bit some bad press.
I saw this meme. Can I
lost
digress for a second?
You can derail us to make fun of United.
I saw a meme on Instagram today. It was a woman waking up from a three-week coma. She goes, "Hi, how are my stocks in Pepsi and United doing?" And I was like, "Oh, you poor girl." I'm sorry. I get very easily amused by that. But but that was great. Yeah, exactly. Like a listed company like United can't suffer anything like that, and therefore they're, I think, more careful to address these issues immediately or...
Well, I mean, to be clear, part of the problem with United is they were not careful in how they were trusted.
Well, and I do think, by the way, one thing that I think United and Uber have in common is not enough competition.
Yes.
Uber has Lyft, which is a biggie, but otherwise...
Not a ton.
No other big players, and there's all this consolidation in the airline industry. I mean, United's own competition, especially domestically, is fairly limited.
The airline industry is kind of a weird thing that could completely derail the show. We should probably not dive too far down that rabbit hole. But yeah, it seems like there's more competition in the airline industry than there actually is when you start digging into it.
Right.
Is basically how that rolls.
Anyway, F the man.
Yeah. but yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like the user numbers have dropped dramatically. It doesn't seem like there's been a whole lot of rebellion from within the company.
It's to Dana's point, too, that, you know, competition is important. Like, I have at least 7 taxi getting apps on my phone. And time and again, I go back to Uber because, A, Lyft's app is messed up. Its prices are higher than Uber's. They won't give me an exact price. They always give me a range, and I always find myself on the higher end of that range, and it's always expensive. Uber is always, you know, more affordable for some reason. And then just the other apps like Get or I guess Halo, which is my taxi now, or Curb. There's just so many options that just don't have the traction that Uber does. And because of that, much as I want to move to Lyft completely and not do Uber anymore, I can't because it saves me money. It saves me time.
So I'm going to ask what is potentially a really dumb question right now.
No worries.
But do you need Uber or Lyft at all? You live in New York City.
That's not a dumb question.
Where you can just stick your hand out and get a cab?
Yeah, well, actually Uber is slightly cheaper than getting a yellow cab sometimes, depending on the time of day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes when there's no cabs around, that's when you want an Uber, right? Like, it's...
I mean, like, I understand that it serves its purpose.
Yeah.
I mean, I took an Uber a couple of weeks ago. I did not get the Uber myself. Somebody else did. But that was because there was like 6 of us and we were in the middle of nowhere in Brooklyn.
Right.
And like need an Uber XL to get across.
Right.
But for the most part, I can usually just kind of like stick my hand out and hail a cab if I need to.
I do it for the convenience. I don't want to like wait around in the cold, like looking on the street to see if there is a cab. I can wait indoors for my Uber to show up. See, I could do the same with Lyft, I guess. But this is like a whole other philosophical question you're asking.
Yeah. Before we move on, I want to ask the same philosophical question of Dana, though. Do you feel it necessary to get Uber, or are you my fellow native New Yorker, perfectly comfortable just stepping outside and waving your hand in the air?
I take Uber sometimes. I mean, it's often not my first choice. The cab rides I've taken this week have all been yellow cabs. Sometimes it is the only or better choice, depending on where I am, what time of day, and the availability of cabs.
Fair enough.
There you go.
Yeah.
But you're trying to
make the lift. I mean, you try getting a yellow cab in the rain in New York City rush hour. It's not happening.
No.
Yeah. And I've fought with people trying to get yellow cabs before.
Oh, you're a converted New Yorker.
Yeah, there we go. So I yelled at someone.
Even I haven't thrown elbows trying to get a cab.
I haven't fought anyone physically, so...
Yeah, I haven't thrown any elbows. I've almost had to throw elbows at a cab driver, but never at somebody trying to steal a cab from here.
Okay, I've kicked a cab before. I guess I'm a New Yorker.
There you go.
Oh, y'all are.
But we should move on from one company that can't seem to escape bad press to another company that can't seem to escape bad press. And a new member of the Verizon family.
Mm. Almost.
Almost. Mm. Yahoo. Mm. Sherlyn, you wanna kick this one off and tell us what the latest development is?
So back in 2007, Yahoo's then CEO, Jerry Yang, had to start a human rights trust fund called, I believe, the Yahoo Human Rights Trust Fund, to benefit some political dissidents in China who were thrown in prison for some reason.
Well, yeah, so let's camp out on that for a moment before we get too far down this road. So Yahoo's history of bad press doesn't begin with a series of hacks in 2014 that they failed to disclose.
Right.
This goes all the way back to 2007 when they turned over identifying information about political dissidents to the Chinese government, which landed these dissidents in jail.
Right. And I mean, it's, since then, we've learned also they've cooperated with a lot of other governments, mm-hmm. ours included, the U.S. government included. So this
in
is
in a way that most of their competitors have not, to be clear.
Yeah.
In a way that Google has not, in a way that Facebook has not, in a way that even, I believe, AOL has not done.
I don't know about AOL, but yeah.
There was a lot of resistance to that sort of thing from the industry at large.
Okay.
But Yahoo seemed to be a little bit more willing to cooperate. And in this particular case, it
landed people in prison
yeah.
for no real reason other than these people just spoke out publicly against Chinese government's like actions. So after he was taken to court, he decided to set up a $17.3 million fund. But then he was speaking with the families of the people who were thrown in prison and had a translator there. And this translator was Harry Wu, and he's a noted human rights activist in China and then has become a U.S. citizen since. But he appointed that person to run the fund. And Harry Wu passed away last year, but it's since come to light that apparently Wu was misappropriating the funds of that trust fund.
So we should say that he's been accused of.
He's been accused, yes. Sorry.
We don't want to say for certain because there's still some legal stuff, you know, allegedly he misappropriated the
but
funds.
It's reported, at least by like documents from the lawsuit have come to light that's shown that he has reportedly used some of the funds to pay himself and his wife $1 million and then set up a museum dedicated to showing off like stuff from the labor camp in China. So it's only $700,000 to about $1.2 million of that $17 million fund was supposedly gone to the intended beneficiaries, which were the 7 or 8 political dissidents and other people who would result.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a huge like scandal. It's just crazy. And then so the suit came up recently this week. Yeah.
And we should talk a little bit about Harry Wu, who wasn't just a translator, but he was a political activist himself. He spent, 19 years in a Chinese labor camp?
For bad reason, too, for just being a political dissident again.
And so he seemed like a good person to take charge of this. It seems like it made sense. It wasn't like a real crony pick, like he was just like a buddy of the CEO of Yahoo.
He was very respected up until last year when some of these rumors came to light. And I mean, I'm not super big or up on Chinese news, but his name comes up and he's well respected. And he had a great reputation up until last year. So this just, I have a lot of feels about it.
Yeah. I mean, the scale of these accusations is kind of stunning. As you said, it was roughly, they were saying between 700,000 and 1.2 million of this money went to its intended causes.
Mm-hmm. So like a fraction.
Yeah. The suit claims that a full 13 million was misused.
Yep.
And that Yahoo executives kind of turned a blind eye to it. Like, they knew it was happening and just decided not to do anything.
That's where I have, I might be the contrarian here. I don't know how responsible they are for that. I mean, you can tell from their dealings with governments and, you know, regional authorities that they've kind of stepped back or are happy to comply with, like, overriding authorities, I guess. And not that Harry Wu himself is an authority here, but it feels like this was more, there are, like, international things involved here.
Well, I think this kind of speaks to a broader cultural problem at Yahoo, which is just their avoidance of confrontation in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, you see that with the fact that they decided to capitulate to the Chinese government, hand over identifying information about political dissidents, that they allegedly turned a blind eye to Harry Wu's misuse of funds in him funneling $1 million directly to him and his wife, to him funneling $4 million to this museum, which, to be clear, is a museum that is part of his nonprofit.
Right.
So he was benefiting himself specifically. To their reluctance to admit and deal with all of these hacks that have kept coming out. In general, it seems like Yahoo just doesn't want to bite the bullet and deal with things, right?
They're very conflict avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
No. I think you're right. I think that, it's about not wanting to be confrontational and, I think, to an extent, not owning accountability.
Yeah. Which is bizarre, though, for a company. Like, this is part of your job as a company, is to do that sort of thing, is to take responsibility for your actions, especially if you're a publicly traded company, you know, and answer to your shareholders and stand up for your customers and do these sorts of things. And Yahoo is like the weird kid who would rather just kind of like nod back into a corner and not speak to anybody.
I'm going to ask a potentially inflammatory question.
Go ahead.
Do you think things will change after the Verizon purchase?
That is a good question and one I am probably not suited to answer.
None of us are. I don't know that.
I mean, it's certainly going to change. It's just in what way? And that remains to be seen.
Well, I don't think Yahoo will be in control of that part of its own destiny anymore.
Yeah.
At least, you know, really high-level issues of disclosing security breaches,
mm-hmm.
Negotiating with foreign governments or pushing back against foreign governments, that will not fall to Yahoo's executive team, which, by the way, I don't believe will carry over.
Most of them will not.
To, you know, after this acquisition. So, my sense, based on what I know, and I don't know very much, they don't tell us anything, is that Yahoo will not actually be in control of that part of its destiny anymore, at least super high-stakes issues like that.
Right. I guess my question was more like, I'm not as familiar with this as you guys might be. Has Verizon had a better track record of being open and resisting of the governments? And again,
no.
No. I mean, Verizon was one of the first major tech companies named and shamed after the initial Snowden disclosures.
Yeah,
and if I remember correctly, they were also implicated in the sort of mass phone tapping scandal under George Bush. So yeah, they're
not looking good there. I don't know.
And we also know that they are a staunch opponent of net neutrality and things like that.
Oh, I remember that now. Yes.
So.
But would I describe Verizon as sort of a milquetoast company that just shrinks from confrontation?
No.
No.
That's 100%.
That I would not say. Yeah.
So I don't know. We're going to have to see how that plays out. I have a feeling that the sort of shrinking violet kind of attitude that Yahoo has right now will disappear to a certain extent. They are being folded into a company that is clearly much more aggressive and much more forward.
And Yahoo was always a company, or long has been a company, that whose main focus was treading water and just trying to stay afloat. Verizon is not worried about its survival. It's worried about its dominance and expansion.
True.
And to Terrence's point, it's a very different worldview than Yahoo's.
So one of the other questions I kind of had about this, and this kind of gets to a bit of what we're talking about in the buyout and stuff, is to what extent this reflects poorly on Marissa Mayer specifically. She has not had a great run of it as CEO at Yahoo. And she will not be joining what is going to be called Oath. Guys, you can take the oath.
Have you? I might.
So she will not be joining the new joint Yahoo AOL company. But this scandal, these issues, all kind of predate her by a pretty significant margin. So this...
I guess so. In our own story, we wrote some of the whistleblowing went back as far as at least 2010, if not earlier. And I don't believe she was CEO then. I think my question would be, and it's not obvious from a first read, is to what extent did the whistleblowing continue after she took over? But, I mean, odds are
she knew.
It did.
Yeah. And that's sort of the thing that I think is continues to be problematic, is, again, she inherited a mess. She inherited a problem, and then it kind of appears that she failed to deal with it properly. Like, this is part of the thing she was brought in to help clean up, and she failed to do it, it seems.
It seems like she was happy to let sleeping dogs lie. Like, if it doesn't surface, let's just not bring it to light.
Yeah.
And otherwise, she focused, it seemed like, on acquiring a lot of different companies and focusing on that instead. So I don't know that I would completely blame her for the underlying issues. I think it takes a lot of courage, to use Apple's word, to bring these up and create trouble for yourself. Because if she had known about these and she had decided, we're going to come clean, and I would, you know, as a company, take responsibility, then
right,
it would be the right thing to do, I think. But
in Mayer's case, the trust was dissolved in 2015, yeah, well after she took over as CEO. So, I mean, as often is the case in Watergate, Russiagate, every other gate, the question is just, what did she know and when?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, and to be clear, these are, like, complicated systems. These are complex corporate structures, and we don't know the exact legal connection between the Human Rights Trust Fund and Yahoo proper.
Right.
So she took over in 2012. And while I find it hard to believe that it would have taken 3 years to dismantle the trust if she had started immediately, it's still entirely possible that she found out about it and started relatively early trying to dissolve it, but that it might have taken some time to do because of legal issues. That being said, she still took over in 2012, and it took until 2015 to successfully pull this thing apart. And now her company is facing a lawsuit demanding somewhere at least $17.3 million, basically.
And that the remaining, $3 million is given just to the beneficiaries, I guess, wholesale, right?
That I would have to do, have to double check.
Yeah. At least from the New York Times thing I was reading. Yeah.
So yeah, they are in a rough place.
Pickle.
do you guys have any final thoughts about Yahoo or Uber before we wrap this up and end on a slightly brighter note?
I'd just like to say that, like you were saying, these are a lot of companies are having similar issues. I mean, even this week we heard Lyko's deal with Vizio fell apart. That's another shady ass company that we'll talk about next time. But
I think
they're not alone.
I think I yelled a lot about Vizio the week where all the stuff about them monitoring your viewing habits broke. I may have dropped a solid dozen or so F bombs on that episode.
I shall go watch it.
Everybody should go back and watch that episode. Oh, yeah. In fact, go back and watch all of our episodes just for fun. It's a good time.
Yeah. I guess I brought that point up is just kind of to ask, like, and really briefly, I guess, like, are corporations, like, which ones are trustworthy? How do we know, like, who's shady, who's not? And, you know, can we trust them? Should people trust them?
I mean, too long didn't read version? No. Don't trust them.
Okay, there we go.
Clearly some companies are more trustworthy than others. But at the end of the day, none of these companies have your best interest at heart. They're all about making money, and that's doubly so of any company that is a publicly traded one. Mm-hmm. And before I get all Bernie Sanders on everybody, you know,
oh.
there's significant issues with the shareholder model of, like, running a company. If your focus is on making money for an elite collection of people who happen to own stock and not for better serving your customers, that is a fundamental problem in how you run your company. And that is how every company is run, really.
Mm-hmm. You didn't say that in a Bernie Sanders voice.
I did not say it in a Bernie Sanders voice, but that's definitely the sort of thing that...
He would say.
That Bernie would say.
Yeah.
But I think it's time to move on to the wind down.
Yeah.
Kind of relax. Talk about something a little bit more lighthearted. We're going to end with you, Dana, because
okay.
yours is a full conversation that we're going to have. But
we call this the wine down, by the way. It's a glass of wine.
If you want to get all Kathy and Hoda and just drink at 11 a.m.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely don't have a problem with that.
I already did. No, not really.
All right.
So next week, we're bringing wine on, is what you're saying.
Well, Kathy Lee it next week.
Yeah. Awesome.
Third hour of the Today Show.
Exactly.
Perfect. There we go.
So, Sherlyn.
Yes, hi.
What have you been watching, listening to, reading? Any good recommendations for the readers out there, or the listeners?
I'll make this brief. I've been watching Big Little Lies on HBO.
Okay.
It's great. Definitely watch. It's only 7 episodes long. And I, in general, can I mention the other one?
If you want.
Just as like a long-running show, I listen to Criminal, the podcast, and that's more of an indie suggestion for all you hipsters out there. Hey. And Criminal is just fascinating. I learned so much, like, nuggets of information from it, and it's a well-produced, like, you know, documentary-style podcast.
So wait, what is Big Little Lies, real quick? Let's go back to the first one.
Okay, Big Little Lies is an HBO TV series that looks at a small town in Monterey, and someone's dead, and you just have to figure out who. You don't know from the beginning who is and who killed him or her, but you go through the entire plot line, and everyone's suspicious. It's like Clue, but in a small town.
Okay. And is it serious? Is it comedy?
Oh God, it's serious and it's amazing. And there's so much HBO graphic stuff in there that it's like Game of Thrones, but less peen. Slightly less peen. So it's great. It's Game of Thrones in a modern
You're
world.
You're really selling it, Sherlyn.
And Nicole Kidman.
Judge my shows based on the amount of peen, to be clear.
Okay, I thought it would be facial hair, but sure.
Well, that's why Game of Thrones, that's number two. That's why Game of Thrones is my favorite. Most facial hair, most peen.
She didn't say pain?
No.
Oh.
Oh, I said peen, Dana. I'm sorry. Oh.
As in penis, Dana.
Oh.
Okay, I guess I should say dick.
Yeah, that would work too.
All right, so.
We were trying to keep it clean and family friendly.
Yeah, there we go.
But Dana had to ruin it.
Yeah.
Dana always like, Dana's
pain. There's also pain.
Yeah.
But it also stars an excellent cast. Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Shailene Woodley, Alexander Skarsgård, they did all a good job.
And Criminal is kind of self-explanatory. It's a documentary podcast about crimes. It's just a crime show. But it's very well done.
It's very well done, and I learned so many things from it. One example, and I'll finish after this, is I learned that there are people whose job it is to watch other people die.
That's horrifying.
It is, and it's amazing. Go listen to Criminal to find out more.
So one quick question about that before we move on is, are they individual isolated episodes, or is it like a serial thing, like it's an ongoing story?
Yeah, individual isolated episodes. Everything's wrapped up neatly.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I will add that to my already unmanageable list of podcast subscriptions.
I know.
I'm going to tell everybody to go check out the new Arca album called Arca, because self-titled albums are, you know, the way to go. Why not make it your third album? He's got two other albums, but the third one's the self-titled. It's an amazing bit of cacophony. You are probably somewhat familiar with Arca's work, even if you don't know the name. He's done production work before for Kanye West on Yeezus. He produced the FKA Twigs album. He's worked with a couple of other people. He worked with Bjork. So
a bit of cacophony, you say?
Yes.
That's how you're selling it.
Yes. It's beautiful cacophony. It's super amazing. It is really beautiful, but it is also very noisy. It's kind of experimental, like electronic stuff, and he sings in Spanish. It's got a vaguely operatic feel to his vocals. Definitely worth checking out. It is super, super good. I've been listening to it kind of on repeat for the last couple of days.
Is it on Spotify?
I believe it is on Spotify. It is on Google Play, that I know for sure. I'm sure it's on other things as well. Wherever you get your music, it's probably there.
There we go.
And now it's time to end with Dana.
Yay.
So last week you were assigned Little Shop of Horrors.
Yes.
And you watched it.
Yes.
And what did you think?
I wasn't prepared for how dark of a movie it is.
You were expecting silly movie about a puppet?
I just thought singing plants, and I thought the plant would be Rick Moranis' friend. Mm. And, you know, you get to the opening credits, you see it's directed by Frank Oz of Muppet fame. You see that the people who did the music are the same people who did the music for The Little Mermaid and other Disney movies.
Which this predates that, to be clear.
It does. So it just was a lot darker than I expected it to be, and I haven't even yet watched the famed alternate ending, which is said to be even darker.
It is significantly darker. And should be clear, this is based on a play. Like, this is mm-hmm. You watched the 80s version of the film.
It's based on the I read this in the end credits. It is based on the Roger Corman movie, which is itself based on a play.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, if you've never seen the Roger Corman movie, is also very good. And stars Jack Nicholson is excellent. I've never seen it put on as a stage play, but I imagine it's got to be just as good. But, you know, it's a very dark movie.
I mean, when you think about it, Rick Moranis is a serial killer.
Yeah.
And I don't like my Rick Moranis when he's a serial killer. I'd rather him be shrinking kids.
Which, I'm just going to throw it out there, not necessarily much better. He almost became a serial killer in Honey, I Shrunk Your Kids, just unintentionally.
But
and only almost.
Yeah.
So.
And then Steve Martin is like all charming until you realize he's an abusive boyfriend.
And a drug addict.
And a drug addict, yeah.
Aw. Wait, are the plants here like marijuana plants?
No.
Okay. So, Sherwin, you have not seen Little Shop of Horrors either?
I have not seen at all.
To your point, though, I felt at times I should have been stoned while watching it, that yeah. I was missing something by being sober.
So,
all of this.
Should we do? Can you give a quick plot synopsis for people who, like Sherlyn, may not have seen Little Shop of Horrors and are unfamiliar with it and live under a rock?
So, Rick Moranis works in a flower shop in New York City's Skid Row. Just all you need to know is it's a bad neighborhood. And Rick Moranis works in the shop. He's sort of a nebbishy, nerdy guy, has a crush on his female flower shop assistant who is dating smarmy drug addict, sadist, abusive Steve Martin, the dentist with brown hair.
Okay.
And we have this plant that is really interesting in the window, and it gets a lot of people to come in and keep buying flowers from the shop. And it turns out this plant needs human blood to survive. So this plant can talk, by the way, and was actually voiced by someone from the Motown group, the Four Tops.
Huh.
And, it can talk, and it convinces Rick Moranis to go out. And, anyway, point is,
do people die?
Yeah. I mean, okay. The point is that the plant gets fed and it gets bigger and more menacing. And then eventually, you know, there's a climax in the movie. Oh, Sherlyn. Not that kind of climax.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
It's terrible.
Go ahead.
Climactic ending involving this big, overgrown, menacing plant. And I don't think I've given away too many spoilers.
No.
Yeah.
That sounds interesting. I like the idea of plant fed by blood, but also, have you seen Scary Movie 2?
Also, no, I haven't.
I think that was one of the references they
probably.
Yeah, anyway, I enjoyed it. I was not expecting such a dark, trippy movie when I sat down. I really was expecting something more
lighthearted and
cheerful and G-rated.
Yeah, and it is not. Huh. And you do need to go track down the original ending, which they filmed. That was your extra credit, which you didn't do.
Well, I know someone who wants to watch the ending with me, so I'm saving it for that person. But yeah.
So for those out there who don't know, the theatrical ending for Little Shop of Horrors is not the original ending. That's not how the play ends. That's not how the original movie ends. And they actually shot the ending. It's been a while since I've watched, but according to Wikipedia, at least, it's 23 additional minutes.
Oh,
it
wow.
goes on forever. And it is not a happy ending. It is super dark and over the top and really amazing.
Nice.
So if you are familiar with Little Shop of Horrors and have never seen the original ending, you can easily find it on YouTube. You definitely should go watch it. It's pretty much the best thing ever. I think I might be one of the few people who thinks that the original ending is better than the theatrical one.
Huh. According to the internet, you're not alone, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know my wife disagrees with me. She thinks it's too dark.
Darker the better, I say.
That's what I think, too. Yep. I think it's time to wrap it up, though. Any final thoughts, guys? No?
Nope.
All right.
Keep it popping, Slime.
Oh, God.
God, I hate you so much.
Love you.
All right. Sherlyn, where can the fine people find you on the internet?
Twitter, Sherlyn Lowe.
Nice and easy.
I know, right?
Dana?
I'm just Dana Wallman. You can catch me on Twitter live tweeting nonsense about movies. Take it or leave it.
Oh, should we give you your assignment for next week while we're here, by the way?
Oh, no.
I think we should.
Who knows what he's going to pick?
Is it Screeners? The one with the exploding heads?
So, by the way, guys, Terrence's wife, Anna, later went into this shared document have and girlied up the list, which I appreciate.
Aww. Yeah, I did share the list with her to get her feedback, and she went, "This is such a boy list." And I went, "Man, it's probably true."
Yeah.
I do not know where the list is currently, Dana, so we're going to have to do this another time rather than waste time on the podcast with it.
I'm going to nominate something myself.
Okay.
Heathers.
Yes. There we go. Do Heathers. Heathers is a solid choice.
Good.
All right, so next week, be ready to talk about Heathers. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Terrence O'Brien. Lots of E's, no A's. Thank you for tuning in. Please, you know, subscribe, share, rate, whatever your podcast app of choice is. The more you rate, the easier it is for people to find the show, and we obviously want people to listen to the show. If you have any comments, complaints, concerns, questions, things like that, you can obviously hit us up on our personal Twitters. You can hit us up at Engadget Podcast on Twitter, or you can email us at podcast@engadget.com. So make sure to tune in next week. We'll be back with another episode filled with probably more nonsense about things and stuff. And stuff and things.
Tech news, yeah.
Yeah.